Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Welcome to this evening's Fireside Chat and to our guests, Dean Tim Beebe, Commissioner Jan Malcolm, and Professor and Director Mike Osterholm. I'm going to get us started simply asking each of them to check in. Let us know how you're doing this evening. Jan?
Well, I'm doing great. It's nice to be with some people who I dearly love and respect in our mutual field, and always appreciate hearing what's up with the leaders that are coming up behind us. And nice to see Dean Beebe, who I haven't seen in, I guess it still isn't in person, but better than an email. So I'm great. Thank you.
Thanks, Jan. Mike, how are you?
Well, I'm recovering. After 3 years, I contracted COVID 2.5 weeks ago. It laid me up pretty well. I have no idea how I got it after all these years of solving a number of major medical mysteries around the world. I couldn't even figure out how the hell I got my own infection. I felt like I had to turn in my epidemiology card to somebody because I couldn't do that. So I'm recovering, and it just points out, I think, how challenging this virus is. Three of us all got infected in one period in one night, and we don't know how we got it.
Well, I'm glad you're recovering, and I'm glad that you're with us this evening.
I will have to tell you just one quick story. So I last June, I was leading a delegation to Cuba to look at the vaccines that the Cubans are making for COVID. They actually have some very amazing technology. And one of the local health systems, which I'm a member of, I contacted them to get some Paxlovid to take with me in case I got infected down there. And the response back was, well, we can't do that, but if you send us a snapshot of your positive test, if you're down there, we'll send you a script. I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? How the hell am I going to get Paxlovid in Cuba, okay? So I ended up calling the medical director, who, believe it or not, was a former student of mine, and asked him if he could help. So I got my prescription. So I had that to start out with, but I had a pretty major rebound, and so I needed a second set, a second treatment. And so I sent an email to the same person. 45 minutes later, I get a response back, and he says, I hope the script went through. Can you check with your pharmacy? I'm on a trip in the high Andes in Ecuador, and I just picked up this on satellite phone. I hope it goes through. So I actually got my Paxlovid prescribed to me from Ecuador, but it worked, and I'm doing better. Thank you.
Oh, good. And we do appreciate the stories. And I think part of the fun of Fireside Chats is being able to share stories and have conversations. So thank you for setting the stage. Tim, how are you?
Doing very well. It's, every once in a while I just stop and think, you know, how I can be so fortunate to serve in this capacity, even for a short time. The school, the university is great, but the School of Public Health, I, from this perch, you're reminded daily of all the skills that exist within it, the work that we do. And so every once in a while, when you're tired, you know, when you're trying to maintain your research program while dealing with personnel issues and, you know, working with the legislature, you know, I just step back and say, you know, I have it. Things are pretty good, you know, and how this kid from Grand Rapids, Minnesota can land in this spot is beyond me. But I'm thankful every day to make it through the day. And to be propelled by just the amazing people that are within this school. So I'm doing very well. If you'd asked me yesterday, I probably would have responded differently. But today, I'm doing well, and I'm surrounded by people I admire tremendously. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Tim. Perhaps this is why we do these on Tuesdays instead of Mondays from time to time. Well, when I ask the interns for questions, I'm always very delighted with what I receive. And some of the questions I did share in advance I really would like us to dive right into some of these questions around the science, the evolving of science that happened during the pandemic, and what appeared to the public in many ways to be switches, to be 90 degree turns, to be reverses, positions that government and policy had on day one were not the positions we maybe had at day 90 or day 365. And some of the interns' questions really centered around compromises being made. But I think before we get there, I really want to start with how you as leaders have handled the evolving science and the, frankly, the politics that came with some of the decisions and the decision reversals that you encountered. I'm not starting us off in an easy space. I know.
Well, I'm happy to start it off. I think it's a great and multi-layered question. Obviously, I am ever grateful for so many things about Mike Osterholm, but he from the very beginning said this: we need to stay humble about this. There's just so much we don't know, and so much that's going to change. So we knew that the science would evolve, and we knew that we would be wrong about a lot of things. Where maybe we didn't know we'd be wrong about quite so many things, but just the nature of the novel virus and the unprecedented scope and scale of the thing certainly threw us curveball after curveball, as Mike often said. But the political dimension to it. It is really relevant because there wasn't a lot of tolerance among the kind of the decision makers in the political sphere, whether that's Congress or state legislature, city councils, or what have you. They really didn't want to hear, we don't know. There wasn't a lot of room for the kind of humility that I think we all felt inside. There was a real desire for certainty and black and white answers that weren't as nuanced as we knew they should be. So I think that kind of started off that way from the beginning, that there was this tension between the reality of how science would evolve and the pressures, understandable, but unrealistic for, cut and dried answers.
Yeah, maybe if I can follow up, I think that first of all, I have to say that thank you, Commissioner. And most of all, thank you, Commissioner, for being our commissioner, because I think your leadership during this pandemic was beyond exemplary. And we all owe you a great debt of gratitude. And somebody whose 5 grandkids live in this state, I never forget that for one moment, what you did. So thank you. Mm-hmm. For me, I had a somewhat of an advantage at this situation, because number one, I'd been studying pandemics for the last 20 some years. I actually wrote a series of 3 articles that were all the same, that were published on the same day in the New England Journal of Medicine, Science and Nature back in 2004, about why we needed to be prepared for pandemics and what we weren't doing. And so I thought a lot about this beforehand. And one of the things I knew right away that this would last for many, many months. And so I put myself into that mode. I'm an old English channel swimmer. I'm a distance swimmer. And I can tell you, swimming a 100 meter dash kind of swim is very different than swimming a 28 mile. You got to prepare your mind in a very different way, even though it's the same kind of thing. And so I did that from the beginning. And the second thing is that I had worked a lot with coronaviruses. I was very fortunate to be involved back in 2003 with our U.S. response. Right after 9/11, Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of HHS, asked me to split my time between the U and his office as a special advisor on terrorism issues, et cetera. And I was still there in 2003, so I was quite involved with our response to SARS and really cut my teeth on that. And then in 2012, 2013, I served as an advisor to the royal family of UAE. And I spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East, on the Arabian Peninsula, dealing with MERS. And then in 2015, when there was a very large outbreak of MERS at Samsung Medical Center in Seoul, Korea, I was asked to come and help investigate that. So I was actually in Seoul for this very large outbreak where someone brought it back from there. So I really had experience with coronaviruses plus influenza and kind of had that sense. And when in the early days of the pandemic, we actually called it, I think CIDRAP was probably the first organization in the world to call it a pandemic on January 10th of 2020 and said, get ready, folks, this is it. And part of that was because having been so familiar with the relative difficulty in transmitting MERS and SARS, but having these case fatality rates of 15 to 35%, we saw something with SARS-CoV-2 that was very different, where there was a tremendous amount of transmission. A lot of it was asymptomatic, and we recognized that by January 10th. And so kind of went into that mode. In the earliest days of the pandemic, my biggest problem was the medical community and the public health community. I got panned royally. In the second week of February, I went to the editors of JAMA, and I said, I'd like to do a policy analysis piece on what's about to happen with this pandemic. Not only did they say no and said, you know, you're just scary, the next week they put together a full-page cartoon, which basically laid out on one side all the risks of COVID and the other side all the risks of influenza and concluded COVID was not the problem. Influenza seasonally right now is the problem. They didn't get it. On March 10th, I was on the Joe Rogan podcast, which was a new phenomenon for me. I had not known who the hell Joe Rogan was until that time. And in the next 2 days, over 10.5 million people listened to the podcast download. And I said in that podcast that I thought in the next 18 months, easily 800,000 people in the United States would die. And that was when we were still talking about tens of deaths in this country, okay? And the people who lashed out most at me for being scary and irresponsible were the medical community and the public health community. And as you know, ironically, in fact, CNN did a story on this, 18 months after March 10th, we hit our 800,000th death in the United States. And in the meantime, it took so many people so long to understand respiratory protection, that aerosols were the primary means for transmitting this, for which the standard masking would not be effective. I wrote a piece in early April in the Washington Post of 2020 saying lockdowns are not what we need to do. And the reason for that is because lockdowns were all about trying to flatten the curve, meaning that we were trying to hold down the number of cases over time so that we wouldn't be overrun in our healthcare facilities. Meaning, you know, if you have 1,000 cases this week or 1,000 cases the next 5 weeks, which one's easier to care for? But it was always with the idea that at the end, you'd have to have something that would actually stop it, like a vaccine. And we had no vaccine for that first year. An example of this is China. They tried to stop it and stop it and stop it and basically hold it down. And then finally, it just blew. And look what happened. In the end, they had the same number of cases. It just overwhelmed them when they did. So I think for me, one of the challenges is the fact that we thought about this in a conventional outbreak manner. We didn't think about this as a pandemic unfolding event that was going to last years. And that was a big, big difference. And then I think Jan hit it on the head is that, you know, I think this idea of humility is really important because we didn't know, but that didn't mean we couldn't lead. So for example, when people would ask me, you know, is herd immunity, when are you going to hit that? My first answer was, and I published a piece on this early in the pandemic saying, I don't know if we'll ever hit herd immunity. We don't know what the immunity from a coronavirus is. You know, if it's going to be like influenza, we won't hit herd immunity because we'll lose that protection year after year after year. If it's like measles, sure we could. But so I think people wanted these kind of answers we couldn't give. But we could give answers that were still meaningful. And I think that was the real challenge. And then let me just conclude by saying one other area I got into a lot of trouble with was schools. And if you look at the pandemic, in the earliest days of the pandemic, in that first 6 to 8 months, kids were not often impacted by this virus, particularly not seriously ill. But then when Alpha showed up, and Jan knows this very well, when Alpha hit Minnesota early in 2021, that was a hell of a hit, just like Michigan. And we saw a lot of activity in schools when the rest of the country didn't. And everybody was saying, see, this is not a problem in schools. Well, then Delta hit, more cases in kids. But then when Omicron hit, we had 782 deaths in kids in a period of 1 month in this country. And you couldn't use the same conclusions. And we saw all these data being cited from the first year of the pandemic. They were no longer relevant because of the change in what was happening with the virus. So one of the things that we didn't do is adjust to the fact that these variants kept changing the game. What was likely for infectiousness, what was likely to cause more severe disease. And so I think all that made it difficult to actually develop what is our end game. And I think we're all still trying to struggle with that situation right now. Sorry, that was long-winded, but.
Well, what I appreciate about what you've just shared, Mike, is the not just the evolving of the science, but also the pushback you received from the medical community. And you've given some examples where you really were trying to educate and inform and give some best guesses, not just to the red states, not just to the blue states. You mentioned the Joe Rogan show. You know, you really were bleeding purple, let's say. And I respect that a lot and feel that's an exemplar and a role model that I personally value. The other thing I would...
Can I just add a piece there, Carolyn, just so yeah. I don't leave Tim out? I think Tim knows this. I don't know if he does or not, but the first time I did Joe Rogan, there was a petition students in the School of Public Health started to get me to resign because they thought that what I did by being on Joe Rogan was so unprofessional by doing that. Yet we were trying to out as public health, everybody is our patient. Everybody is our concern. It doesn't matter if you like them or not, or if they're red or they're blue, or if they're young or they're old, if they're rich or they're poor. And it was interesting for me to get the pushback from the School of Public Health students who thought that I did something that was very inappropriate by going on Joe Rogan and trying to reach, you know, literally 20 million people ultimately.
Well, and I'll see if Tim wants to say anything about that. There are a few more things to follow up on for sure for the group. There are students that are still protesting and refusing to use Spotify as a service in protest of Joe Rogan being on Spotify. Yep. So again, it speaks to the complexity and really the diversity, I think, even within public health of perspectives on where and how we engage in protest. Tim, is there anything you wanna weigh in on there?
Yeah, I mean, so again, thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. I'm so happy that to be in a state that listened to evidence and a governor that responded to evidence. Thank you for that. I said just a story about Mike and I were out west in Seattle a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago. and a person came up to me. I was outside the restaurant we were at and came up to me and asked where I was from. I said, you know, I'm the opening act for Mike Osterholm. So he said, I just want to say that, you know, he ran the system that treated the first COVID patient in the nation. And he treated the first healthcare worker that contracted COVID in the nation. And he said, I didn't get any help from the CDC. I tried to get guidance on what to do. I tried over and over, but you know who consistently gave me guidance, updated guidance? Was Sid Rapp and Mike Osterholm. So that was, and
thank
he,
you.
And he was emotional. He just, you know, no matter how, you know, how challenging it is, there's that sort of hit. I just like, I was so proud to be in this discipline and so proud to be at this university and from this state at that moment because they were foundering. I mean, imagine treating the first case. And not knowing where to go. And there's a lot of reputational rebounding that CDC has to do now. I'm happy that we stood in that place. So just one last thing around the knowledge. I do a lot of work with healthcare delivery systems and talk about an audience that was clamoring for guidance on the evidence. And the evidence was changing by the hour. And so we set up a COVID knowledge synthesis unit that went through all the recent published data, even you know the like Med Archive, the pre-publication, to try to synthesize that work for practicing clinicians. What do I do? What's the latest? And we put like quality scores on it so they could get a sense of what to do and try to feed it to the front line through the EHR and nudges and the like. But you know, I mean, the evidence was changing hourly. And there was just a lot of lack of clarity on what to do. So what we tried to do is have, you know, put, you know, meta-analytic and, you know, some math to the synthesis and to try to provide the best information at that time to the practicing clinician. So it wasn't easy. And I think people had a better appreciation for the sort of tools that we can bring to this to help guide that. So it was a very interesting time, and we had to kind of change of how we did our systematic reviews and knowledge synthesis. It was more hour to hour rather than a 6-week process, you know?
Thanks, Tim. So Mike, as you were sharing, the other thought that came to mind was the good trouble that John Lewis speaks of and spoke of. He wrote it in the essay that he asked to be released after he died. And he spoke about just getting into good trouble. And of course, he was speaking to a lot of the injustices and the active protesting and not being violent, and yet using your voice, your words, your feet, your hands, your mind to protest injustices. And in a way, you've been the public health good trouble guy for the country. And I'm going to bring up one more example and ask if you want to share it. And certainly Jan and Tim will have complimentary comments, I'm sure. Masking. I feel, Mike, that you put out some opinions about masking and got a lot of heat about that as well. And I don't recall the exact situation, but I wonder, you probably do. And I'll also acknowledge there could be some students here who signed that petition for the School of Public Health, and if they want to offer counterpoints, they're more than welcome.
Well, first of all, let me just say that thank you for the very kind suggestion of good trouble, because John Lewis was someone I actually knew and someone that I still think incredibly highly of. You know, good trouble people don't exist in a vacuum. And I think for the students here today, one of the things you should learn is one of the reasons I could be a good trouble person, because people like Jen Malcolm and Tim Beebe gave me cover. And I think that is really important. And I think Jan did that often for the governor. I think, Tim, you helped do that for the university, where you have to give cover in a sense to let someone be on that edge of good trouble or pushing the envelope. And it's about the team that comes together. You know, Jan knows that, and some of you know this, but, you know, I was at the health department from 1975 through 2001. And when I started at the state health department, there were 4 people in all the area of infectious diseases, 3 of them were bachelor level. And when I left, we had over 70 people, of which a third were doctorate level. And, you know, we really built that into an academic health department, and Jan did an amazing job of supporting that and continuing to move that forward. But I think I have always had that love of that place. And to watch the health department go through what it had to go through with the pandemic was very hard for me, because I saw the stress. We all lived it. But I think that's an important piece about that really the cover to provide that. In terms of the issue with respiratory protection, this is an old issue for me. We saw this early in the days of influenza. We saw it with SARS and MERS. And there's an entire body of science, aerobiology, that very few people really have the expertise to understand and judge, who think they do. They actually think they do. And it turns out that much of infection control in this country is an error of understanding what aerosols are all about. You know, an aerosol is that fine particle that floats in the air. Imagine if you're in a room that's the size of an average conference room and somebody's smoking in one corner of it. You think that within a very short period of time, you're going to smell that smoke on the other side of the conference room? You damn bet you are. That's an aerosol. Perfume in a department store 2 aisles away, and you can smell it, and it's because it's an aerosol. And early on, we had data that showed that this was a major mode of transmission And yet we had WHO and CDC who fought that loud and clear. And lives were lost because of that, because we didn't. Today, to this day, we still have hospitals, many, who use procedure masks, which are not adequate to stop an aerosol. You have to have tight face fit and filtration. And in fact, twice over a period of 4 weeks in this city, in this Twin Cities, I went to hospitals where I had my N95 fit tested on, and I was told I had to take it off and put on a procedure mask because that was the standard practice for that hospital. And I said, no way in hell am I going to do that, okay, which I always got away with it. But it was just pointing to me the lack of good understanding of what's going on with the aerosol-based transmission. Now CDC has relatively embraced it. And it was interesting, the chief scientist for WHO, who left 4 months ago, on her exit interview said the one thing that bothered her the most was how badly WHO handled the issue around aerosol transmission and what they said and didn't say about it. And so I think that today, if you want to protect people, again, we have clear and compelling evidence. You have to have an N95 comparable respiratory protection to do that and face fit in it. The other thing is, finally, I think so amazing to me is, even if you were wearing a procedure mask, which is not tight face fitting, which does not have the milk-borne cord material that has the electrostatic charge, but we did a study at our center where we followed a set of TV news shows showing crowds and everything at night in news. Consistently, since the beginning of the pandemic, over one third of the people who did wear some kind of face covering always wore it under their nose. That's like replacing two of the four screen doors in your submarine, okay? You know, what the hell good is that? And no, you know, and that just was normal, you know, and you say to yourself, where are we missing the messaging here? So I think that respiratory protection continues to be a major challenge.
Thanks, Mike. Jan or Tim, any other thoughts or perspectives, just as we talk about the national and global leaders not keeping up, and then as a state and as a university needing to really make decisions in the best interest of our citizens that didn't always coincide with those national and global leaders?
I think that was a significant dimension of what made this so hard. I knew we were in big, bad trouble the day I heard the president say to the governors, you're on your own when it comes to testing. There is no national, I mean, the president did not say there's no national strategy, but that was the meaning of his statement, that we're on our own to find the supplies we needed. I think he actually said something like, we are not your mail clerks, or some, you know, really kind of dismissive language like that. And I just thought, oh my God, we're going to be on our own to try to compete against each other as states for these limited supplies. And you cannot manage a pandemic that way. I mean, we couldn't put a bell jar over the state of Minnesota and, you know, keep all the virus from ever coming in here. And so, you know, I mean, I think our state we sure worked our tails off and our hearts out. I think we did a credible job, but it's really hard to, you know, part of the frustration was all the states doing things differently. And then people would opine on the data. Well, gee, you know, the states that had more stringent restrictive measures didn't do any better than the states that were wide open. I mean, and failing, of course, to adjust for all the relevant variables. But there's some essential truth to the fact that you really cannot manage something like this at the state level or the institutional level. And I hope that's a lesson we take from this, is that we have got to build a more robust international, global surveillance system and do everything we can to clean up our abysmal data on what the heck is going on. There's just so much we really need to take away from this and build much, much stronger systems to take the place of the patchwork that we had, which as you say, Carolyn, we had to try to do our best absent a lot of the things that we absolutely were expecting, whether that was the strategic national stockpile or better, you know, better, more consistent metrics or faster data turnaround from CDC. I mean, there's all kinds of things we need to do better as a result. I'm heartened. I'd be interested though to know what Tim and Mike think about this, that CDC seems to be digging in and acknowledging that some really significant, you know, sort of foundational, fundamental things need to be improved as a result of all this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tim? I mean, I agree. I think the dissonance in messaging really opened the door for disinformation. You know, I think we didn't do ourselves any favor by acknowledging, I think it goes back to what Jan and Mike said, the humility. We wanted to answer questions that we didn't have the evidence to answer. And I think some use that as see, they don't know what they're doing. They are imputing a control motive to these things. And I think that's really unfortunate that, you know, what is really kind of the arc of science and research really was seen as sloppiness or motivated by other things that comport with a particular political view. And I think that then now we're reaping those sort of, you know, that poison fruit from that. And so, but, you know, it was a novel virus. I think, you know, if what we learned from this is not only just data structures and rebuilding the public health workforce, but just humility, you know, don't get in front of your skis. I think Mike, you've written a few things on this. It's just, and you've done this kind of consistently. When asked a question, you just say, "We don't know." You know, that's okay to say we don't know, but you know, but all us overeducated people, of smarty pants, sometimes don't feel like we can do that, right? Especially in public health, where we've been historically invisible. You know, and now we're kind of out front and center. And this is our time to actually offer value. And sometimes we just maybe overstated things. And but I do think that this sort of dissonance that between the federal and the state level opened the door for a huge amount of disinformation and you know, chasms that exist within my own family. So
that's, you know, I think. Caroline, in follow-up to Tim's point here, I think that we weren't in a position where we couldn't make predictions about the future, make statements that in some cases were difficult. We just had to provide the data or the basis upon which to say it. For example, you know, I was on the Biden-Harris transition team from November to January of 2020 to 2021. And boy, did I get crosswise with the administration and a whole lot of other people, because I saw what was happening with the variants. And it turns out that in the first year of the pandemic, we were continually told by the viral geneticists that the variants were nothing more than rings on a tree, like just told you how old the virus was. And then when an alpha came along in November, and we saw a much more transmissible virus, much more likely to cause severe illness, virus, one that was actually associated with an increased occurrence of long COVID. Suddenly everything changed and said, wait a minute, this virus, and thinking the long term, has got some new curveballs to throw at us, and things could get a lot worse. And the second week of January of 2021, right around time of the inauguration, I was on Meet the Press. And I said, I thought the darkest days of the pandemic were still ahead of us. And you might have said I said really bad things about all your mothers or something. You know, Nate Silver gutted me in the media the next several days. The White House called me and said, you got to shut up. You know, I mean, I heard a lot of that. Well, from the day that I said that on Meet the Press, 80% of all the deaths in this country have occurred since that time associated with COVID. And all I did, I wasn't like I was some great, you know, oracle. I just said, look at the data here, what's happening with these variants and subvariants. And this could mean a very, very major change. And of course, along came Delta and along came Omicron, and look what happened. And so I think that we were in a position to make some important long-term statements, but we had to provide the context for them. So I don't want you to walk away thinking that people like Jan and Tim and I couldn't say things that were challenging and were in the end right, but we did it based on the data. If we had no data, then you had to say, I don't have any data, I don't know. But I think that also was how do you don't get ahead of your skis? Tim said it really well. You know, a lot of people got ahead of their skis. How do you stay right at the edge of your skis and keep the speed up without actually getting ahead of them?
Yeah, no, I think that's all exactly right. And I think, again, part of what made this so much harder was the way in which it became just flat out politicized. Nobody really cared, quite honestly, about the data or the quality of the data. Because if I said, as I did in front of legislative committees, I don't know. The answer coming right back was, well, the guy from West Virginia knows, let's have him come in here and tell you how to run your health department. I mean, you know, because it was just every legislator thought they knew, you know, as much as Mike Osterholm about what was going on, you know, and I don't know what to do about that. I mean, I think that was one of the most painful things, frankly, is the degree to which things got so politicized that, you know, you can have different opinions about how to solve a problem, but if you don't even agree there is a problem, there's no such thing as common data, then that's what we've been working in for the last
year. And I think the other thing, Carolyn, that Jan is too humble to say, but she withstood hurricane force winds relative to the darkest side of life. Some of us got death threats, lots of bad emails. Mm-hmm. And for me, at the University of Minnesota, actually the U campus police, together with the FBI, had to actually follow up on a number of emails that I got that threatened to do harm. And I got to the point where, for me, you know, I didn't dismiss them, but I, you know, it was people who, in an anonymous way, could be big, okay, say whatever the hell they wanted. It wasn't until I got my first one that said, I know where your daughter works, and your grandkids go to school. You know, this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. That changed everything. I mean, I got to tell you, I cried myself to sleep that night wondering, what have I done to set my kids up? What would happen? And then just look no further, what happened yesterday in Tennessee, and you can get a sense of what I'm talking about. You know, you just never know. And I think that was so hard for many of us. Jan put up with so much. I don't know how you did it. But I think that changed as a public health issue. I've never had that happen before. Never have I seen that before like that.
Yeah, that's a really good sobering reminder, Mike. And as I was thinking about what all the examples all three of you were sharing, I was thinking about these interns and the upcoming future workforce and future workforce leaders that are listening to these sobering stories. You're demonstrating for them so much strength and humility and the examples of the pandemic, not knowing. But also, I don't want us to lose sight of how much knowledge you did have. And at the start of this, you shared lived experiences and examples that said you were prepared to handle and able to be flexible. And the example I'll give is the skis and the skates. So here you're giving the example of, in the pandemic, you don't want to go beyond the tips of your skis. You needed the data now, and you knew the data were changing tomorrow or the next day or next week. There are other issues and other topics where we say you need to skate to where the puck is going, not to where it is. So you're demonstrating leadership, and I really hope the interns can see this, that depending on the situation, that really drives the type of decisions, the type of processing that you're doing. And it comes with a lot of challenge it can come with a lot of conflict, a lot of politicization, and compromise. And I'm going to ask Hoden to offer a question, and then we'll shape up the end of the time together, asking for some of your recommendations for well-being and for good podcasts or books or movies or things you do to enjoy or to keep yourself somewhat refreshed. Let's go to Hoden.
Thank you, Dr. Porta. So as leaders in the field of public health, we know that many decisions are made regarding the health of those that you serve. We understand that lots of thoughts are put into those decisions. Many of those decisions aren't easy ones to make. So as you reflect on the past few years of the pandemic, especially in your leadership roles, is there an example from the pandemic response that you regret or wish you had made?
I'll just offer kind of more of a micro level. I was within my family. I'm the youngest of six, and by far the most accomplished. I underestimated how dismissive people could be of expertise, right? And I regret that I didn't take seriously the perspectives that like my brothers brought to the table. They kept on saying, well, I think this, and I said to one of my brothers, opinion is the lowest form of human knowledge. And then game over. We didn't speak for another couple of years. So just how you handle those who have been fed disinformation, how do you engage them by not insulting them, how, meet them where they are. And so I regret that sort of, because I just was put back on my heels. I thought, are you kidding me? I mean, you're going to go off of a video, that you've seen versus, what Fauci says or what, the school of public health is finding. And I reacted, but I'm just like, we review and adjudicate evidence daily, mm-hmm. So I didn't handle it well, and it had a big impact on my family. So that's more of a micro level and how to handle those who are trying to find a way to meet them. And I didn't handle it well because I was pissed.
I appreciate the vulnerability. Are you talking now?
Yeah, we are, but we don't talk about the pandemic. We don't talk about it. We talk about kids and cars and hockey.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, Tim, I share some of those same experiences and feelings about how difficult it is to not get extremely defensive. I have extended family very similarly. A whole bunch of them are strong anti-vaxxers for a whole variety of reasons. Some because they're, organic everything and don't trust anything that they didn't, grow or make themselves. And others are I don't know how it happens, but they're conspiracy theorists. I mean, and I've struggled too with how to engage with them. But I've decided I'm some of it is just okay with certain things we won't talk about, but it's hard to do, but I've learned a lot by saying, tell me more about, what the experiences that you've had that leads you to think this. One of the things, and I'll maybe segue to what do I wish we had done differently? And here's again, it's a real conundrum. This is not a simple answer, but all the deaths in long-term care facilities, which were horrible. That could be a whole discussion on the ethics around that and the attitudes about about whether we overreacted because after all, people were going to die anyway, because mm-hmm. of their age and whatnot. But the things that we did to try to limit transmission in those facilities by prohibiting visitation, for example. With families, while we couldn't really control the coming and going of the workers in the facilities, but yet we clamped down like a ton of bricks on the families not being able to mm-hmm. to visit. And I think that that had enormously big negative health impacts of its own.
Yeah.
So I'm really not sure that we did the right thing by keeping people as isolated as we did, even though it was motivated for, you know, very mm-hmm. logical reasons. But I don't think we got the balance right on that one. And I think we need to just think about how are we going to handle that in the future? Mm-hmm. Because it the way we did it had some very, very big negative repercussions that were arguably as bad as the virus.
Such a good example, Jan.
Yeah, well, and I would agree with Jan 100% on that. And just to follow up on Tim's very thoughtful comment, I was part of a group that we call it the Gourmet Group. There were four couples that got together for a better part of 20 years for a dinner once every several months at one house or another. And when the pandemic began, of course, that ended. But what was challenging was one of the four, my male colleagues in this group, a very well-educated individual, was just an anti-vaxxer. And we had several conversations. And finally, the last conversation I had with him about 16 months into the pandemic, he really got upset with me. He was on the phone and, you know, and I don't ever hear this again. I'm done. Don't call me. Don't talk to me. And it was really painful. And 7 weeks later, he died from COVID. And I think to myself, what could I have done? How could I have done something more? You know, what did I do wrong? And knowing that, you know, I couldn't have done anything else. But I think that that was at the micro level. When you have those kinds of events, that really is very, very challenging. And I know people who had that with their families. On the macro level, the one thing that I think we have not done a good job on at all, and I do plan on doing much more about it, is we gave the media a free pass largely in COVID. And the media was responsible, not social media even. They had their own issues. But the general media was not prepared for this. And they brought a lot of reporters in who had no skill sets whatsoever in health reporting. They had no editors that had skill sets in health reporting. And they contributed to a fair amount of the confusion. And part of it was who they actually picked as their experts. You know, there were groups that, if, you know, for example, one of the modeling groups that was very well known and prominent, we actually have gone back and evaluated that, and they were wrong about 85% of the time. And nobody in the media ever did a check. They would put them on and say, oh my God, the next 3 months, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. We had individuals who came out of medical schools, et cetera, that made all kinds of comments that if you go back, they were wrong. And I think that one of the areas that we need to do much more to be better prepared for is how does the media handle this and who makes the decisions? I actually had a producer after this time that I told you I talked about on Meet the Press that actually said to me, you know, we're just decided you're too scary right now to put on. We just, you know, they told me that. You know, I didn't ask to be out. They said, you know, you're just too scary. And it was interesting because, in a sense, they didn't know how to cover it. They were trying to, you know, what does their audience want? Their audience wants to be reassured right now. Their audience wants to be comforted. Well, if that's not what's going to happen, though, you can't do that. So I think that one of the areas we need a really careful review and reflection upon is the media. And they need to do it themselves. And we're trying to push them to do that. To ask, how did we handle COVID? What did we do? What didn't we do? And who are our experts? And how did we use them or didn't use them? And I think that was a real challenge.
Thank you for that, Mike. And thank you all for the examples that were personal, that were somewhat micro level in long-term care facilities, and macro level when we think about the media. I do want to say that we won't have time to get into the space of talking about about long COVID, about aspects of those who could not be vaccinated, up and coming immunotherapies, those aspects of things. We're not covering vaccine injured. We're not covering the politics of some of the policies at university levels or healthcare system levels. There's a lot so many topics and perspectives, and I really want to acknowledge that we don't have the space and the bandwidth to go into all of those, and many are complicated. Even within the world of public health, there are differing perspectives on the approaches taken, and hopefully tonight, some of that has been highlighted and explained in a way that makes sense, a little bit more sense maybe than it did before this conversation. Okay, let's pause for a minute. There are a couple more things. Mike, you were just on NPR not that long ago, and you brought up the origin story and your indifference to the origin story. And boy, there's pieces there that could be fun to tease out. What I want to ask instead, though, is the question of just what you enjoy listening to as a podcast, or what you enjoy doing to sort of entertain yourself. Are there books you're reading? Are there movies you're watching? Anything that you might recommend? And it doesn't have to be academic or scientific, yeah. But I'd love to hear from all three of you. We compile a list that we maintain online for the interns and general public.
So I have to say, like, at the beginning of the pandemic, when it was just so dark, I have been a huge fan for many, many years of the genre of books around, like, this dystopian sort of, you know, what happens after pandemics or zombie attacks, you know, what happens to the social order. I put those aside during the pandemic. I needed to watch Parks and Recreation and old reruns of Cheers. I mean, we binge watch just to escape the day-to-day stuff. So, but now, you know, my podcast, I listen to The Daily from the New York Times daily. I think it covers very important things so well. So that's my go-to podcast, as long as I can stay awake till the end of it. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, I just, I couldn't read a book for 3 years. It was a matter of time, but more than that, it was my mind, my brain. I couldn't sustain concentration just to enjoy reading. And that really scared me, because that's always been one of my absolute favorite things to do. I can, my ideal of a vacation is to take 5 books along and sit in some lovely place where it's warm and read, which I could do in my living room, but it's prettier on a beach. I've rediscovered reading, which I'm so happy that my attention span is now back. So I think I'm reading books that other people read years ago. So it's like, I just read this great book, and somebody says, yeah, I read that 5 years ago. So I just read A Gentleman in Moscow. I thought was really wonderful. And another one was called We Must Be Brave. I kind of like historical fiction. And this one was set around wartime London. It's a lovely story of finding home. So 2 books. Besides Mike's podcast, I'm not a podcaster yet. I have to learn to listen to things as I'm walking. So that's my assignment to myself.
Thank you. Mike?
Well, I read a lot, but I tend to read a lot about work or current affairs, current events. You know, the world's a 24-hour place right now. But I think for an escape, one is I love romantic comedies, and I just can totally, you know, disassociate from the world and watch those. And I absolutely think the prescription for successful life only can happen if you watch Ted Lasso. If you stay up current on Ted Lasso, you have a lot of good going for you, okay? So I would urge everybody to do that. I can't wait till Wednesdays right now when the new edition of Ted Lasso comes up, okay? I think that for me also, one of the things that maybe more than ever I appreciate is just the ability to reach out and talk to people you care about, people who are scared, people who are concerned. And And it's not, I don't know who gets more therapy out of it, me or them. And I think that that has been a very, very important part of my entertainment almost, is just to be able to know that that is really very important to do.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jan. Thank you, Tim. You've been personal and vulnerable and reflective. And I know everyone who's listening tonight and will listen will be very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.